So session two, remembering Sophia's psychology after Jung's red book, The Lament of the Dead. For whoever well-meaningly tears you away from the dead has rendered you the worst service, since he has torn your life branch from the tree of divinity. He also sins against restoring what was created and later subjugated and lost. C.G. Jung, Liber Novus, the Red Book. To start out today, I want to talk about a really extraordinary book, an extraordinary dialogue, conversation between Dr. James Hillman and Dr. Sonu Shamdasani. The Red Book was published in October of 2009. I think the release date was actually October 9th, 2009. And a lot of us really wondered, a lot of us, people I talked to and myself, wondered if Hillman would even read this book. It had seemed that Dr. Hillman had been in a pretty conflictual relationship in many ways with his own interchange with Jung, with Jung's ideas. And Hillman at that point was old. He was ill. He was suffering from cancer, and he was often in quite a bit of pain during those last years. And so here he is at the end of his career, and this entire new thing is laid in his lap. And immediately after the book is published, on October 9th, people are asking Hillman to talk about the Red Book. He'd never seen the damn thing. He knew of its existence. He had no idea what was in it. But of course, he's one of the more prominent voices in the Jungian community, and people are asking him to make comment. So here he has laid in his lap this work that is so different than anything else of Jung's that he has ever had contact with, and he's asked to make comment. And he did make comment. In fact, I heard some of his early comments shortly after release of the Red Book. And it was clear at that point that he really hadn't read very much of it, that he hadn't understood much of it, and he didn't really have that much to say. And having heard those interchanges, my own impression was that he may never actually read it. And I wasn't laying that on him as some fault. I mean, good heavens, he's done a life of work. Now, in the last years of his life, at a time when he really is not very well, he's supposed to incorporate this entire new piece of Jung's history into his understanding of a man he's spent 50 years trying to understand. So I heard him speak in June of 2010 at the Library of Congress in an interview with Sonu Shamdasani when they had the Red Book show at the Library of Congress. And when I heard that talk, my impression was the guy really doesn't get it. And he's not going to. Well, I was wrong. I was really wrong. Beginning in October of 2009 and onward through the last 2 years of Hillman's life, and he died in the fall of 2011, privately, Dr. Shamdasani and Hillman got together for conversations about the Red Book. And Hillman was reading it, and he was trying to understand it. And I'm going to say Sonu, because it's a whole lot easier to say Sonu than it is to say Shamdasani again and again and again. And I'll refer to Hillman by the name of Hillman, because I can get away with that one. So Sonu and Hillman had these conversations, and they recorded them. And as they began recording the conversations, they realized that this was something that they were going to preserve historically. This was really an historical conversation. There were not any two men who had been more involved with Jung's work from entirely different perspectives. Hillman had gone to Zurich around 1952, I think is when he arrived in Zurich. He was involved with the analytic psychology of Jung. He was trained in that tradition. And then he went on, probably starting around, particularly around 1970, to separate himself from this cult, analytic cult, in Zurich, which he thought was very much wed to conceptual language and almost a theology of Jung. It seemed to him a Protestant theology, a monotheistic theology. And in the 70s, as we spoke about last time, he really broke away with that essay, Psychology, Monotheism, or Polytheism, and went his own path. Sono Shamdasani had become interested in Jung, I think, when he was about 18 or 19. He happened to come along at a time when there were still a lot of people alive who had known Jung very well. Early in his life, Shamdasani says he was interested in becoming a psychologist. But at a point, he turned and saw that really the interesting thing was the history of psychology, or psychologies. What were people doing trying to develop these psychologies? Because there were so many and they were so different. What was the story of psychologies? Maybe we had to understand that history before we could understand any specific approach. And Sonu said that it was Hillman's book, Revisioning Psychology, that really opened him up to the potentials of this study that he has now spent his life working on. I think Sonu is now maybe 52 years old or so. And he's been working at this stuff since he was in his around 20. So these two men sat down for a very interesting conversation about Jung, his work, and his Red Book. And they ended up calling this conversation the Lament of the Dead. And then the subtitle, Psychology After Jung's Red Book. The presumptions of that subtitle are striking. That psychology changes or is changed by the Red Book. That this somehow, this publication of this book, somehow is a delimiting moment, a defining moment in a before and an after. Both of these men are in agreement that it is, and that becomes quite clear in their conversations. After reading these conversations, and also after reading the very fine biography of Hillman published by Dick Russell, and this biography was recommended to us by Dr. David Miller when he was here. After reading that biography, I realized that I had greatly misunderstood Hillman. There were things about Hillman that I had found irritating. I thought there were things he had not understood, and we'll talk about that in our next session. But the man had understood a great deal. And what I also came to see is what he had been through in Zurich, what he had been responding to and breaking away from. And in many ways, I find myself in sympathy with what he did. Much to my surprise, I'll say, much to my surprise. I've really been surprised by Hillman, particularly in these dialogues. The first five conversations in this book, which comprise about half of the text of the book, outline a project that points to a complete reassessment of psychology, or at very least Jung's psychological project. These conversations provide insights into psychology as it may come to be, as it may result, if we can understand what Jung was saying and doing in this big red book. I've read through these dialogues several times. When I got the book last August, I went through it two or three times. In preparation for this lecture, I read all the dialogues again. And every time I've gone through it, I've seen more in this frank, in this intelligent and open-ended conversation between two highly educated men. And I think this conversation should be engaged by anyone attempting to understand Jung and his Red Book, or his psychology, or his history. So I'm going to read from the text quite a bit today in this first morning session. This is an interchange of voices that should not be paraphrased. or reconstruct it. And of course, what I'm going to do here is I'm going to cut. I want to pull some things out of this conversation. It's a tapestry of ideas, of interchanges. Very personal, very direct, very open. I'm going to pull one thread from that tapestry in this session. My intention is that you find the conversation interesting and go and read it yourselves. In fact, read it several times. Then turn to the dead, listen to their lament, and accept them with love. That is the phrase from the Red Book that became a title to this book, These Conversations. And I, once again, I'll indicate Hillman's words by his name and Sona's by his. James Hillman. This is the beginning of the conversation. I was reading about this practice that the ancient Egyptians had of opening the mouth of the dead. It was a ritual. And I think we don't do that with our hands. But opening the Red Book seems to be opening the mouth of the dead. Sonu. It takes blood. That's what it takes. The work is Jung's Book of the Dead. His descent into the underworld, in which there's an attempt to find the way of relating to the dead. He comes to the realization that unless we come to terms with the dead, we simply cannot live. And that our life is dependent on finding answers to their unanswered questions. Hillman, the unanswered questions. Sonu, we think we're posing the questions, but we're not. The dead are animating us. Hillman, but the questions. Jung says there that we think the figures we uncover in our dreams or in active imagination are the result of us. But he says we are the result of them. Our life should be derived from them. We just think of it wrong. We think that whatever comes to us as something left over from the residue of the day, images that are composite stuff, garbage from life. But Jung is saying these figures that come to us in our dreams and even in our thoughts derive from these figures. So the task would be uncovering the figures, which seems to be what the Red Book does. He allows the figures to speak, to show themselves. He even encourages them. Sonu, descending into his own depths, he finds images that, in a sense, have preceded him. It is a descent into human ancestry. It is the ancestors. It is the dead. This is no mere metaphor. This is no cipher for the unconscious or something like that. When he talks about the dead, he means the dead. And they're present in images. They still live on. Hillman, but what are we to do now? What are we to do with this extraordinary thing? What are we to do with psychology? So many people have been in psychology or been in Jungian analysis or been Jungians or engaged in this work of his or the results of the work. What do we do now? Because it seems to me those 18 volumes of his collected writings have to be reconsidered. They don't seem to be in the Red Book. Sonu. I've sometimes thought that if a fire broke out, what text would I take? This is the text of Jung that I would take. And I would leave the rest. You can reconstruct so much of what is essential in what is to come in the rest of the work from this text. You can reconstruct much of what would come in the rest of Jung's work from this red book, this Liber Novus, this new book. You know, I think Dr. Shamdasani would agree, all of those 18 volumes of Jung's collected works, a shelf that big in my bookcase, are somehow linked to Liber Novus, the new book, the red book. And that is really what Sonu means when he says it could be reconstructed from this, the rest of it. But in fact, I do not think that it could be constructed from Liber Novus by anyone but Jung. What would have happened if Jung would have published this book in the 1920s? That's a question we talked about in our discussion a little bit last night. Can you imagine it? Would anyone have understood, without adding in the next 40 years of Jung's work, his explanation? And his influence, his broad influence in culture generally. Without the rest of Jung's work, a reader would probably just throw this whole big book on the dung heap of history. I'm not sure any of the 18 volumes of Jung's collected works, and I should add, we have 18 volumes of Jung's collected works. There is actually a substantial amount of material still in archive. This is one of the things that Shamdasani's been working to do, is to bring some of these things that are unpublished, including seminars. Jung really did lots of seminars. He preferred talking to small groups of about 10 people. He didn't like talking to big crowds because there was more personal interchange, more aliveness in the dialogue. But he gave these seminars over years, and they were recorded from the 1920s onward. And many of these still are unpublished. And that's what Shamdasani is doing right now with the Philemon Project, is bringing several of these seminars into publication. And some of this stuff is the most alive stuff, because he was talking to people. He wasn't talking to a scientific audience. He was talking in his normal manner of dialogue and interchange. So I'm not sure any of these 18 volumes of the collected works can now be understood without the Red Book. But nor could Liber Novus, the Red Book, be understood without those 18 volumes and the 40 years of work that Jung put into explaining his hidden book. Those published works, which have now been available for a half century and more, were Jung's exegesis, his interpretive key to Liber Novus, the Red Book. That interpretive task perpetually turns back to the Red Book. It unlocks it. The collected volumes of his writings and the Red Book are two very different voices, but they are in dialogue. Each helps us hear the other. I've talked about this at some length elsewhere. I'll just review quickly. Liber Novus was what I call Jung's primary hermeneutics of vision. These events happened to him. Events. Experience. But what did he do? He had to bring this thing that had happened into form, into sensual perceptible form, into word, and then word and image. The words came first, the manuscript. And then he took this manuscript and spent 16 years calligraphically transcribing it and reflecting upon it. And the images that came in then over the next 16 years were further reflections on what had happened to him in 1913, 1914, 1916. Then came what I call the secondary hermeneutics. And that was really developing a medical-scientific language, a way of talking about events such as he had gone through. The visions, the primary hermeneutics, interpretive act of bringing this into a form, and then talking about what it was to have such an event in one's life. How do you understand this? Where is this experience in human history? In human history, among our dead. Where is it? How do we approach this event in our history, this fact of our humanity? First is the experience, the perception and interpretation. And that is what Jung spent from 1914 to 1926 really working, or 1930 working upon. Second comes the exegetical language, the what we might call conceptual language, what Sonu and Hillman call the medico-scientific language that Jung developed in his collected works. Jung's conceptual language. Hillman and Sonu continue talking about Jung's concepts, the language we have heard for nearly a century. And last month we talked a bit about precepts and percepts, about syntax and semantics. If you remember that, consider how this relates to the conversation that follows here. Sonu. Well, this, the Red Book, is Jung without concepts. You find Jung expressing the essence of his activities, tasks, his oeuvre, without a single conceptual term. There is no archetype. There is no unconscious. And he gets by quite fine without it, without those words. In fact, he manages to express himself in a more fitting and particular way. Hillman. So when you save this book from the fire and let the others go, evidently that's the implication. A lot of the concepts would go. Where would we be in psychology if the concepts were gone? If the concepts were gone. Sonu. My sense is that those concepts were a makeshift. They're an attempt to try to translate as much as he felt he could get away with to the medico-scientific audience of his time, as much as he felt he could get away with to the medico-scientific community audience of his time. Hillman. Well, he defends them, the concepts. He defends them too. Sometimes he says a concept in German is Begriff, and a Begriff means able to get a grip on something, to take hold of it. Sonu. Yes. And there is a utility in it. But there's also a sense of a traducement. And traducement means a line, a speaking badly, in bad way. There's also a traducement which contrasts with that which he engages in this text. He speaks about words. He speaks about concepts as an attempt to tame the incomprehensible, the chaos. And in this text, he tries to do away with that as much as possible, to confront the immediacy of his own experience. What he engages in is a lyrical elaboration, an evocation, an attempt to find expressions so that the images resonate. They're able to speak. So, to take for one example, there's one of the chapters in which he meets a one-eyed vagabond, a desolate figure, who ends up just dying in the night. In his reflections on this, he speaks about the destitute, the beggar, who wants to enter in, who wants acceptance with him, and comes to think that he had cast aside his beggarliness. And he had not accepted himself because there was this desolate vagabond that he had thrown away. He doesn't attempt to translate it. For instance, to call it, using his later language, the shadow. He speaks about it in terms of beggarliness, destitution. He allows the metaphorical word to open up. Hillman. So he's really using the language of literature and drama and poetry. He's using descriptive or concrete words about what's going on in the psyche, not second level abstractions. Sonu. Yes. Hillman. Yes. But we psychologists, we are taught abstractions, systems of abstractions. Yes? You see the point, their point. What is the traducement, the betrayal or the lie in conceptual language? I gave a lecture in Los Angeles last year, and I showed a picture of Philemon, the picture from the Red Book. And in the back of the picture there are two trees in the picture. And I'd show in the picture as part of the lecture. And afterwards, a fellow who's getting his doctorate down at Pacifica, who had heard some of my other lectures on the internet and come to hear this one in person, came up to me and we were talking about the picture, and he pointed at the picture of Philemon and the tree in the background. And he said, "Now this is the tree of life, isn't it?" And my response to him is, or was, "That is the tree that Jung imaged and painted." Conceptually, you see, you can bring it into that box of whatever the tree of life has meant culturally, historically, and personally. But that is the box. You can't put that tree in the box or it dies. You can't cut its roots from the fact of the living image. There's a difference there. You see what I mean? And this is something else I really encountered immediately after the Red Book was published, when people were first trying to get a hold of this thing. And they were reading it. I went to several of the things that the Philemon Foundation was doing in those first months after the book was published. And there had been people at those events who had been waiting most of their lives. Some of the older ones, like me, with gray hair, who had been thinking about this Red Book ever since they read Memories, Dreams, Reflections, you know, 50 years ago, some of them. And so here they were flipping through the book, and they were seeing things in the pictures, because the people looked at the pictures before they read the text, right? The pictures were overwhelming. And they'd look at them and say, "Well, that's Jung's anima. That's his anima right there." It's like, yeah. Conceptual box. That was not Jung's anima. That was the experience that was later in his scientomedical language used to reflect the experience, concept and experience, this definition of events of human life. Then they talk a bit about abstractions, precepts, and this conceptual language. Sonu. This is a private text initially, although it's written for others. He's working on it for publication. it's an elaboration of a personal cosmology, which is not conceptual. It presents the framework in which he refound orientation and meaning in his life. And that wasn't provided to him by his concepts. His concepts were of utility to others. And that was part of his, you could say, physician's task, to provide something for others that would give them orientation when they faced the dark night in their own underworlds. And there's a problem that enters when one confuses the two. So to read this text and to translate one language into the other is to traduce it, betray it. He could have used these conceptual words had he so wished. He could have used these words had he so wished. Hillman. So that leaves open for us who read it to discover another way of speaking psychology. It's closer to the phenomena as they appear. Sonu. There are heights and the depths. There is not the conscious and the unconscious in this text. There are powers of the depths. There are principles of the depths. Hillman. And their voices. Sonu. And their voices. Which he hears. Hillman. Yes. So how would we work if we put those 18 volumes of the collected works aside for a moment, and the concepts in them, and the systems, and the typologies, and the diagrams, and so on? We put that aside. How would we practice a psychology? Or do we disband psychology? Sonu. Sonu said, so that leaves it open to discover another way of speaking about psychology. A manner of speaking that is closer to the phenomena as they appear. And 20 years ago, I gave a class on Jung at the university. It was called C.G. Jung, An Introduction to His Life and Work. And Naomi here is the one who got me hooked up with that 20 years ago. It might have been more. I won't even reflect on it.
More.
Yeah, thank you. And, well, during those courses, I spent at least half of the semester working up to this period and talking about this period in which the Red Book was being done. I really understood that this visionary event, this fact of experience, was the core of Jung's work. But I had a hell of a time with the information I had conveying this to people, that the rest of the collected works was a reflection upon this period. That's the way I'd read the collected works all these years, because I'd understood this very early on. I'd had a teacher who had helped me understand this in a variety of ways. But it was hard, or nearly impossible, to convey this. It was frustrating to me. The analogy I've used many times in prior talks is that Jung was an explorer. He came back from a journey in the dark land, metaphorically, and he tried to make a map of where he had been, of what he had found, a map that would be useful to others who might also go there. The map was not the terrain. It was not the journey. It was just to help orient others. When they entered into unknown lands, unknown psychic worlds, you weren't supposed to worship the map. And you know what? You weren't supposed to just stare at the map and not take the venture itself. But the map has become, in Jungian studies, particularly in the practical application thereof in analytical psychology, and this is very much Hillman's point, the map has become the precept, the syntax. It is fixed, and we try to shoehorn things into it. We have a dream and try to parse it into all the syntactical mannerisms of Jungianism. Oh, ho, I've seen this. This is the shadow. This is the anima. And here is a wise old man. You get it. Such usage can gut the reality of the psyche as real terrain. It is not the map that is primary, not the concepts, not that language. It's the place. It's the experience. Maps lie. I've encountered that. I've gotten lost as a result of it. They traduce, betray reality. So, they go on talking. How does psychology employ its concepts? I mentioned that book by James Hollis last night, Hauntings. I quoted from it. Hollis made a comment in the book that I found appropriate. Let me just read what Hollis said. And once again, Hollis wrote this book before Lament of the Dead was published. This is his own observation, okay? This is what he says. The practice of psychiatry soldiers on. And I should step back. Hollis has been a psychotherapist in practice for some 40 years or more now. He lectures quite a bit, but the man is really engaged in this work. And this is an impressive thing about people who are engaged in the work, who talk about it. They're speaking from experience, of real people, of real events, of real problems. So Hollis says, the practice of psychiatry soldiers on, describing, diagnosing, and medicating disorders. But cataloging them as phobias, addictions, dysthymia, or whatever, does little more than sprinkle the magic dust of naming on invisible energies. It is as if naming them gives us power over them. This fantasy, this hubris, however, this hubris means that the spectral presences have even more power in our lives. The more we think we have them, the more they have us. The real question is, how can we track those energies, those spectral presences? From whence do they come? The gods, the environment, the tribe of oneself. What do they ask of us? How does consciousness appraise that demand, wrestle with its quandaries? What will we have to serve if we serve those hauntings? What change, what risk is asked of us? End quote, Dr. Hollis. Now think about everything that gets shoved into the old DSM-4 Axis 2, for those of you who've worked in therapeutic environments. You have to put this Axis 2 diagnosis in, you know, into this thing that people write in charts. I see this hundreds and hundreds of times when I go through medical records. As Dr. Gardner pointed out in his seminar with us last year on narcissism, this whole realm of so-called personality disorders, things that are called Axis II in the diagnostic manual that has now been replaced by the DSM-5, this whole thing was makeshift, contradictory, overlapping. It does not fit the facts. We force facts to fit the category. Sprinkling the magic dust of naming on invisible energies. Apotropaic. The word means warding off evil. Names are apotropaic, a type of magic spell to hold off the mystery. Concepts. Sonu. I think one has to look at how psychological concepts are actually used and were developed in a task to complete the scientific revolution. The notion was psychology was to be the master science that would underpin all the other sciences. Well, this clearly didn't work. We've got as many psychologies, almost, as there are people. And the one thing that I think all psychologists have in common is they don't agree about anything. Apart from that they use the word psychology. So you have to ask, is this a science? Clearly, a lot of productive work has gone on under this enterprise. Hilden, I hear the way that psychology uses its language as apotropaic, as a way of covering the fundamental anxiety that we do not know anything really about psyche. And so we have developed systems that ban the demons, or that ban the unknown, which the psyche remains as. Jung said again and again how little we know about what we're talking about. Sonu. These concepts are used, as you say, as bulwarks against the unknowable that breaks in and sweeps us under anyway. Hillman. We don't know what we're talking about. We don't know what we're talking about. Sonu. Or we are part of what we are talking about, in the sense of the problem that animated Jung, of reflexivity. There is no outside because it is ourselves that is the question here. I think that Jung does see a therapeutic function in conceptual language, in the sense that for some people, without this, there is madness. It does have some utility. Hillman, so it is apotropaic. Apotropaic. Warding off evil, making amulets, sprinkling magic dust. But does conceptual language have a therapeutic value? A therapeutic function?
To help the professional continue to feel superior.
Aha. A motive of power. We have the magic language. We have the amulet.
Or separate from the pain or anxiety that is for you.
It separates us. Well, that's what the apotropaic is it pushes it away. That's what it meant. That's what the word means. It means to push out, away, against. Control an energy. You know, I've met over the years many patients who come in and use a diagnostic category concept as their name. I am bipolar. Or 20 years ago in Salt Lake City there was an epidemic of I am a multiple personality. That epidemic quieted because the therapists who were working with it and using that term, quieted, I suppose. But I remember a time back in the 90s when I met patient after patient who came in saying, I'm a multiple personality. And I don't see them anymore. I don't know what happened. Maybe the therapist cured them all. I don't know. Could that be it? Is conceptual language necessary? A necessary handrail along a dangerous passage? We'll talk about that in a minute more. Go ahead.
I'm reminded of a phrase that says, there's two ways to lose God. One is through religion and the other is through rebellion. So just once you're practicing the religion, it itself can become a container.
Yes, container.
It insulates us from something else. As can rejection, which I'm sure from a clinical basis would have to be. Anyway, it was just an observation.
And we're open to observations. Observation, madam?
A lot of Nietzsche's work is about this, is about the imprisonment of theory and even of practices, religious practices, and what could come out of that psychically for us. So he's always arguing that, not that you can get rid of the concepts, but I believe that Aristotle's right, that we are conceptual, that that's the kind of animal we are. But if you can become experimental, if you can recognize that every time, if you use multiple personality disorder, or borderline, or bipolar, or whatever, because every single thing we say and think is conceptual, that you do it with the idea that it is an experiment, it's a moment, and it doesn't, it's not, even though there's a tendency toward the concretization, that it isn't. It's a fiction. That you use, well, and you would like this because it's a pragmatic idea that theories are really just what works. And that changes over time.
Yes. You just actually said something which I just reflected on. I've had people come in with multiple names diagnostically. No one ever comes in and says, I'm borderline.
They do in my clinic.
Oh, they do? Oh, okay, all right.
Yeah, I thought that was one of the hot ones 20 years ago.
I have really bad borderline personality disorder.
And they come in and identify themselves and say, I'm borderline? That's interesting.
Really bad borderline personality.
Okay.
So I had another observation.
Go for it.
As you're talking about this, drawing a parallel, maybe you are too, between connection with the dead and the means by which we keep the dead at a distance, the idea of the dead even at a distance, and paralleling that to going into the human experience of those of us that are alive, and that we ward off through concepts, but through other trappings as well. I mean, you think of the trappings of the physician. I mean, all kinds of means to assure that the horror, I suppose, or the essence of who people are, doesn't contaminate them or doesn't have us. So I was thinking of people, Jung, for example, who wanders into that area specifically with the dead. I was also thinking of R.D. Lang in the 60s, who wandered into the life of the those who were mad in those days, or in those days defined as mad, and in England. And so there's this sort of courage, or I don't know, it's courage, or a way to have to begin to think about it in terms of what do we do with all of this?
That story of Lang, he got this old building, a fine old Victorian building, and invited all of these psychotics. Some of you know this story, the schizophrenics, to come and live there with all the psychiatrists and just to all live together. No particular program. Just to interact. And there was actually a weird documentary movie made about this back in the 70s. I got a copy of it. It's the strangest thing you will ever see. And you know what happened? They tore the damn place apart. They broke out the windows. It was a disaster. But it was an experiment.
Who did that? Was the psychiatrist or the patients?
I think Knowing R.D. Lang, I suspect he was probably knocking out some walls too. I mean, there is a story. There was this one schizophrenic lady who was curled up in a corner in this naked in this room, just curled up in a corner, completely catatonically, you know, inverted. And Lang took off all of his clothes and sat there in the corner with her naked, crying.
Naughty.
But essentially, he was trying to enter in to this space to see if entering in this way, in some fashion, would make, I don't know, a difference. It was crazy, yes, but it was an exploration. The guy did not know. He did not know how you fix it. And he was willing to try his own madness in the approach. So, moving on. James Hillman. We haven't really discovered how to go on talking and practicing what's called psychology, even defining it, even confirming what we know. And yet what you call our epistemological insecurity is fundamental. That is, we don't really know what we're doing. So new. And you say, if after 100 years they haven't agreed about anything, well, they aren't going to. It seems to me fair enough assumption to draw, and we have given it enough time. And one asks, what has the enterprise been about? It has, to my mind, functioned as a means of providing individuals a form of articulating their experiences. It has provided certain languages, possibly in some cases deficient, in some cases more enriching, which bring fuller articulation to their experiences. Hillman. And so you become then a member of this or that tribe within the giant system because you're using the same language. Sonu. Yes. And what that language can do is enable individuals to find a way through the chaos of bearing their experience. Hillman. And Jung, in a sense, offered such a language. Instead of talking about the bottommost and the beggarly and the derelict, he invented the figure of the shadow, the personified concept of shadow. So he's trying to do it. It's as close, in a way. Sonu. It is as close, but also with one caveat, in that he didn't want to turn people into Jungians. He didn't expect his scientific apparatus, which is how he saw it, as something that provided meaning to people's lives. He saw the whole enterprise is about enabling individuals to find their own language, develop their own cosmologies. As he says, he eschewed using concepts within his therapeutic practice. If someone comes in talking about spirits, he talks about spirits. I take that very seriously, and it's borne out by accounts I found in diaries and letters of his practice. To enable individuals to articulate their own linguistic worlds. Hillman. And not translating. Sonu. Not translating. So the conceptual language is there as part of his scientific enterprise. When he's reflecting on this and trying to constitute a science. But his practice is quite different. And his self-experimentation, his own self-investigation, is quite different. Hillman. This would indicate that each person, each individual, would use the language that is given by the figures that he or she deals with, or confronts, or appears. Sonu. Yes. That's the first conversation between Hillman and Sonu Chamdasani. That conversation took place, I believe, in October of 2009, when Hillman was just beginning his engagement with the Red Book. And of course, Sonu came to this at that point with 14 years of struggle with this book. Dr. Chamdasani has said that when he first found the manuscript of the Red Book, he had no understanding of what this was. When he read it, it made no sense to him based upon all the other stuff he had known. His prior decade and more of deeply being involved in Jungian studies, in his letters, his work, his history.
Lance, just another observation, something kind of played out in the world, I mean in the world of psychotherapy at least, in the Freudian dynamic psychotherapy was a therapy of interpretation. It was a therapy of concepts, of helping people understand their experience by putting it into concepts. And what's interesting now is, for example, I mean, here's what you're talking about, and in the culture, in the therapeutic culture, now we have Susan Johnson, for example, with her emotional focus therapy, who puts particular emphasis on, and says it over and over, that when you're engaging people, she works mostly with couples, but when you're engaging them, you engage them in through use of their language. I mean, and the concepts are, we're talking about it, you know, putting it in a context later, but the work itself is entering the world of those people. And it's interesting that she also harkens back to the time of the early times, and sort of the stuff that was standing beside dynamic psychotherapy, standing beside Freudian psychology, the work of Fritz Perls, I mean, which has that basis, for example, but Bowlby, and I mean, all those who were doing this other kind of work that didn't get the emphasis at the time that Freudian psychology got. But here it comes now, you know, some 50 years later, 40, 50 years later down the road, and it's standing beside this as this now comes 40, 50 years down the road.
I think that one of Chamdasani's projects would be to, and has been, is to say, it's not just coming along, it was always there.
Yeah.
But the emphasis of our culture. Right. And it's interesting that the book that Freud published in 1900 was called The Interpretation of Dreams. Psychology, this analytical or psychoanalysis, began as a hermeneutics, a way of interpreting human experience. Hermeneutics is very much hooked up in this entire psychological project, and this has been a key realization for me now for decades. Something I've been dealing with and trying to explain.
Here. So, to what extent, I wanted to bring this up last night, but I didn't. To what extent can Gigerick be exonerated in your eyes? And mm-hmm. I'm not sure that that's mm-hmm. that possible. Mm-hmm. In the sense that he gets this, and he's pointing this out, and he's saying psychology, logy, not psyche, not mm-hmm. psychic experience, mm-hmm. not psychic feeling, but psychology is, by definition,
a
kind of universal language. And yes, all theorists need to understand there's not just a hermeneutic, there is a kind of ethic, a kind of hygiene. Hygiene is a really good word. To recognize that anything conceptual is distorting. And abstraction is by nature taking out the personal and the individual. And so what Gigerick is warning people, maybe you don't need the warning, but maybe lots of millions of people who are Jung fans might need, is that what the Red Book is a kind of, it's not a conceptual map, but it's already a freezing to some extent of the original experiences of Jung, and you should not jump to the conclusion that his original experiences are something that would be universally shared.
I would agree with that. I don't think Giegerich needs to be exonerated. I mean, the man speaks well enough for himself. There's a basic presumption in what he says that I think is contrary to Jung. I believe that there's really a lot of value in Giegerich. I mean, as I tried to indicate, I have taken personally great value in encountering his writings. I think the fellow is brilliant, but he's missing something which is important. And that is the independent reality of psyche. And this is something that's very hard for me to describe in a way, but it was part of Jung's feeling as well, is that we live in a sea of psyche. It's not something that we can conceptualize ultimately. I mean, we can think about it, and we should indeed think about it, but we live and swim in it. And this is the other thing, is that maybe it was before we were. Now that is, you could say, well, that's a metaphysical statement. Okay, it is a metaphysical statement in one way, but another way, it's just a story. It's just a story. And that story I have more sympathy with, because I feel my story and the human story in that story, that she was.
That's, so what is John, what does he say? He woke up and he saw her.
Yeah,
what does she say back?
She is every word. She is the word. She is every word that he could say. You know, I said basically the myth as I told it, it was this, that the Gnostic myth is in the beginning there's everything and nothing, and then something changes. And that change happens when mind meets its conception, when nous meets epinoia, the first conception, the first thought. It's relational. So the minute everything stops being the big soup of everything and nothing that nothing can be said about, the minute that border is crossed, there's a relationship. That's a story of consciousness, if you will. We can't pull everything back into the mind, into nous, and say, well, you know, this thing, this world, this cosmos, this tissue of life that we're encountering is just really our thought. Uh-uh. It's here. We meet it. It's part of us.
Just to pick up on psychologies, as autonomous homo, we would each have a logos. And maybe the best we can do in just the logos is to drop cookie crumbs through the forest as we journey, and which would attribute to this chaos in the science of psychology. A second point, for me, I would see that the Red Book is Jung's individual psyche soul experience, whatever that is, and as his personal magnum opus, it is the unification of himself with the collected works. Because he tries very hard in the collected works to just speak science,
yes.
Even though occasionally his personal theology tends to rise to the surface. I think he always checks himself because he knows that this is his audience, that he must be able to debate with, to be able to converse with. So the two are completely different dimensions. And I would see that this is his personal unity.
They talk about that. Let me go on. In the second conversation of these, there are, I think, 15 conversations. The second conversation begins here. Hillman says, if psychology after the Red Book is our theme. What is that psychology going to be? What is the Red Book telling us about the psyche? What came to Jung in this book? Sonu, what he grapples with is the weight of human history and ancestry. He realizes that he can't move forward without going back, without undertaking the implications that the past weighs on him. And this is not purely in a personal sense, which has been the main preoccupation in psychology, but with history as such, in particular, with taking up unfinished business, taking up unanswered questions. Hillman, it's the history of the soul. So the history of psychology really means the history of the soul. And if psychology is to move, it has to speak to the soul, and it has to speak about the soul. That's the crucial thing about psychological language. That psychology, after the Red Book, has to find another language. And we've got to talk about that. But this weight of history is such a weight. Sonu. He finds that his innermost, the most deeply subjective, is no longer subjective, and that it opens out into something far larger. And that's what, in a certain respect, saves him. In the depths of his solitude, his isolation, in his confrontation with himself, he finds an opening. He finds that what animates his depths is the weight of human history. In the sense, the figures he encounters there, such as the mythic figures and biblical figures, his deepest conflicts are expressed in the form of the interplay between these images. Hillman, that's very profound, because it's always imagined in usual psychology that the deepest conflicts are between my life, me, in some strange way, and the various other figures. Auden says, we are lived by powers we pretend to understand. That's one of Hillman's favorite poetic quotes. It's the powers who give us our deep personal life. The usual understanding in psychology is actually a pretension, if we follow Auden. You pretend to understand. It's a pretense. Sonu, this is what Jung realizes, that what he had hitherto taken to be psychology had been an explaining away. He thought he had encompassed the soul, but he had turned the soul into a dead formula. And his attempted explanation had simply killed off the subject matter. The subject matter in this sense, it's quite specific, is fantasy. His own fantasy had dried up under the weight of the pretensions of explanation. The psychiatric and psychoanalytic in 1912 sense of rational explanation had simply expired, in that if you look at the formal explanation of the time, it's tracing back fantasy to personal determinants, to complexes. And this really was what Freud was doing, that this stuff that was coming up in fantasy was really a repressed material of our life, of our sexuality, of our instinctual conflicts. That was his hermeneutic. Hillman. But then he says, this is the basic activity of psychic life. This fantasy making, And he uses the term image, not from after image, something you've experienced or seen, but he says he takes it from poetic usage. Now that's a huge step. So new. That's one of the main results he arrives at after the Red Book. Hillman. Well then, I think psychology after the Red Book has to be based on the fantasy image. It has to use the language of the poetic, or the analogous, or the metaphoric, or anything that is not, so to speak, denotative. Denotative. Now, Hillman says psychology has to use a language that is not denotative. What is denotative language? Denote means be a sign, mark out. And contrast it to the word connote. What's the difference? Connote means to mark in addition. The idea or feeling that a word invokes in addition to any literal meaning. Language is a metaphor of the experience. It does not box the experience in word. Denote it, equal it, serve as the full equivalent of it. Now, Giegert, in his review of the Red Book, really dismissed it. Basically, it's just, well, what he said in his newest, one of his newest books, What is Soul? He described the Red Book as, quote, the primitive form of a careless, sloppy scribble, contingent, fragmentary products, unquote. That's on page 173 of the book, What is Soul? Hillman and Shamdasani both disagree. And they comment on Giegert, I guess, in passing. They refuse to mention his name. Hillman says, one of the criticisms of the publication is, well, these were Jung's crazy scribblings. Notebooks, diaries, half-formed thoughts, and the kind of stuff that belongs in the drawer and doesn't belong out in the public. Because what belongs in the public is the finished work, where he's been able to put his mind to it. These are early works and are not really important. Not just early works, but actually incomplete works. That's the criticism. And Hillman says, now, in fact, this is absolutely invalid criticism. Because the work is highly articulated, highly mastered, and 15 years or more of it. So that criticism, that this shouldn't come out because it's just ordinary scribblings that anybody does in their notebooks, is not valid at all. Hillman is responding to Giegert. And they had some very strong responses in the last years. They weren't on the same page. Sonu, elsewhere in the dialogue, states, you know, this, and he said this many times in various ways, this was the single work of Jung's to which he gave the most time, the most consideration, and the most effort in his life. He really gave 16 years of consideration to this. I mean, this is a man who could write a 600-page book in a few months. He did that with Psychological Types and published in 1921. This book was the most considered work in his entire collection of works. Then they go on and talk about myth. Sonu. Another term to introduce here is that of myth. So if the question in 1912 is, I need to know what my myth was, by 1930, Jung had found it. Now the question was, how could he help others find their myths? Simply to find one's own myth, simply to find one's own way in the world, to be able to find meaning in one's own existence, is insufficient. or it was insufficient for Jung. He had to find a way to enable other people to find their own myths. Hillman, isn't the myth that he's looking for the fact that myth is what he's looking for? Not my myth? Sona. One critical aspect of that is the notion that to find one's own myth is inherently contradictory. The very notion to evoke the term myth implies something of generality. You can't have a myth if it's just yours. Then you're talking about an idiolect. That's insufficient for you. That's not what he's talking about. That's why the question then is still with him. Okay, he's done this. But the question of generalities is still there. Sonu very frequently uses this term, personal cosmology. Personal cosmology. And he goes on to say, actually, in his comments, that this makes no sense. The word is itself contradictory. You can't have a personal cosmology. In this comment, he really addresses that with Hillman. Yes, this was Jung's personal cosmology, his myth. But it wasn't meant as an idiolect. Idiolect's a private dialect. There are people, you know, they have their own languages, and they're entirely their own. And you meet these people and you can't really understand what they're talking about, but they know what they're talking about. It's their dialect. It's the way they talk about life. But we all have a bit of our own idiolect. The point is that Jung said in 1912 that he realized he needed to know what his myth was. And Sonu agrees there in that conversation with Hillman that by 1930 he had found it. What was it? What was Jung's myth? And this is really what I've been arguing, trying to add in as a hermeneutic to what Jung was doing. I have argued it might be understood as the myth of gnosis.
Myth of what?
Gnosis. Gnosis. That is what I wrote last year in the foreword to Dr. Alfred Ribby's study of Jung and Gnostic tradition. What I said there is in 1930, Jung had found his myth. Those are Sonu's words. I hadn't seen them at the time, but that is an affirmation. Not many people have made that. In 1930, Jung had found his myth, and it was the myth of gnosis. And I see no evidence that it ever changed. Of course, there are complexities in such an assertion. What is gnosis? What is its myth? And that's something that really is awaiting our better understanding. And it's something I've tried to begin addressing in the seminar last month and in things I've been doing for the last several years. Let me give you just a little bit more of this conversation before our break. Sonu. I want to say a little bit more about his conceptualism. There's a sense I get that he saw it as offering a safety rail for those who would be unable to encounter themselves without it. It had an apotropaic function, but one that nevertheless was of therapeutic benefit and of utility to some people. Hillman, a safety rail. It's curious. Because he didn't have that safety rail himself. He didn't use those terms when he was engaging with the figures. Sonu, quite the opposite. So you get expressions like, "This was the night on which all the dams broke." The face-to-face with the chaos of primal experience. Primal as, in this case, figural experience. Hillman, Still, he thought that for the people he was working with, they needed that safety rail, that guardrail. Sonu. They needed something. It had a therapeutic function. And he felt able to convey something. Hillman. But you see, the inheritance of that is that 60 years later, or 70, 80 years later, there's a world that follows this guardrail, this guide rail, and is afraid. And it has put the weight of human history, all that incredible material, back down into the depths of the psyche. And it spends its time with the guardrail. Sonu. Well, I think it's even worse than that. They've mistaken the guardrail for the essence. Hillman. Exactly. Sonu. So, for instance, if you take the collective unconscious as Jung's myth, as some have, then you think the conceptual system is the essence of his work, rather than his own cosmology. That cosmology is what I see as his myth, not the conceptual system. Everything gets turned topsy-turvy. Let me just give the last part of this. I think I have to go for this. Let me go through this. Hillman. And now this book is so crucial because it opens the door or the mouths of the dead. Jung calls attention to the one deep, missing part of our culture, which is the realm of the dead. The realm is not just of your personal ancestors, but the realm of the dead, the weight of human history, and what is the real repressed. And that is like a great monster eating us from within and from below and sapping our strength as a culture. It's all that's forgotten, and not just forgotten in the past, but that we're living in a world which is alive with the dead. They're around us. They're with us. They are us. History as therapy to psychology. And this is a really key part of the things that come out in this conversation. It really is very much Shamdasani's approach in becoming a historian of psychology. Hillman says, the first thing that we have to do, the way of doing this, is opening all kinds of barriers, opening all kinds of walls that have been constructed so that we're completely permeable. And that means allowing all kinds of wacky thoughts and dreams and fears, all sorts of things, to pass through. Sonu. And it also goes back to what you were saying about the weight of history, in that a present is then animated by the past. Sonu. In a way, in historical practice, in the broader sense, this type of conception is essential. The whole endeavor of historical practices is to historicize the present, to indicate, look, what appears to be intractable should be reconceived in a different way. And you can then, as it were, loosen something intractable by indicating that it has a certain historicity. History appears to be able to loosen the intractable. Hillman, by getting into history? Sonu, yes. By retracing its formation, its contingency can be revealed. By retracing its formation, its contingency can be revealed. New ways of thinking can be generated so that, to me, is what I see as the significance of the history of psychology. It opens new possibilities, and it opens up the possibility of reclamation. One is able to show, for instance, that what appears in psychology as contemporary issues are not in the least bit contemporary. That some of the brightest minds at the end of the 19th century were grappling with the self-same problems. Hillman, that's a tremendous moment to close this little chapter. Understanding that the historian is the therapist. They must recognize that this bit of history, which is the Red Book, is their therapy, the therapy of our time. So new. It gives them a new way to envisage their issues. They are connected with something that one would have considered to be utterly remote.
I just want to make sure I'm following. The day, who is the day there? Is that the therapist?
They must recognize. Well, Hillman says they must recognize. And I think he's talking about all psychologists. And he's one of them. They must recognize that this bit of history, which is the Red Book, is their therapy. The therapy of our time. Sonu, which is us, you. They are connected with something that one would have considered to be utterly remote. Hillman, it couldn't be more remote. Sonu, there's the man tracking his fantasies by Lake Zurich, transcribing them in an ornate Gothic script for 16 years. Hillman, with figures from Gnostic and arcane past, everything is so absurd and radical and weird. That is the arcane to what's missing in the culture. History as therapy. End conversation 2.
I was just going to say, I think the patient or the victim of life intuitively, before perhaps even contemplating a therapist, intuitively understands that he or she is a product of his own history, and intuitively is plowing through that chaos before they ever make this connection to a professional who can help them organize it.
That's very much what Hollis talks about in his book on complexes, on the hauntings, that we're lost in it. And when we come to therapy, into therapy, in Jung's complex psychology, it's actually starting to look at it in a new way and seeing how these things can be given names, conceptualized, maybe even giving the patient that therapeutic handrail of ways of looking at what they're going through.
If all of the deads were for you that one night, it seems to me that the youth of the 60s tried to break the dams and the rest of the culture put the lid on really tight. Well, that's missing metaphors, but yeah.
The 60s did have a transformative effect. It was weird. But a lot of things got shaken by the chaos of that period, undoubtedly.
Yes. I have been having these two images kind of keep resurfacing. I thought I'd share. And one is a quote from Marion Woodman, when she defined what psychotherapy was to her. And she said it was to find the soul and to love it. And I thought that was a great definition of what these guys are trying to put together. But that would involve a relatedness to the soul, which this, how do you pronounce that word, atropotetic?
Apotropaic.
Yeah, that word. That would involve relating instead of utilizing that relationship. It would involve a relationship of love and compassion. Kind of the golden rule, actually. Do unto me as you would have, you know, do unto them as you would have me. That golden rule. The other image, though, is the icon of Christ after the resurrection. And he descends into Hades. You probably have seen that icon. He's descending into Hades, and he's lifting up the tomb, the cover of the tomb, to release the souls that are in there. And I'm thinking that might be Jung's myth that he's living out, is this kind of this resurrector, or releasing these captive souls and bringing them into liberty again. But anyway, I just wanted to share those two images.
With regard to the first image, Jung understood at some point in this Red Book process that he was, and this is what he says in the Red Book, a lover of the soul. Mm. He was in relationship. He was a lover. And he writes this beautiful long, what I call ode to Philemon, to his spirit guru. And he calls Philemon too a lover of the soul. And he saw that across history there were humans who had been lovers of the soul. And that love relationship, that eros of a relationship to the soul, had been part of the lives of our dead, of history. And I suppose if I were to say, is there a point of difference here between Giegrich and his logic and Jung and his love of the soul, it is the relatedness. Yeah. Giegrich is thinking about this, and he's thinking, well, I mean, the man is brilliant. I really accept that. I see what he is thinking, but he's not in the relationship that I am with this soul fact. That's the relationship I felt in my life, the relationship I sense between Logos and Sophia. You see, there's an eros in this relationship. There's a unity. And with regard to that image of separating out the dead, look into your depths, pray to your dead, your depths waken the dead. That image that I gave you last night, that scripture I read from the Gospel of Philip, which was written probably in the second century, about those who inherit, the dead who inherit the living, live. And we live with them into the future. That idea had existed in this idea of resurrection. But, you know, it isn't easily dogmatized. But there is a soul fact of relationship there. Let's stop there. Let's take a brief break, and then we'll get back in.
Just one little comment. Just an example of dam breakage, fairly recent and fairly local. I think what happened in southeastern Utah the last few years with the intervention of the collection and selling of Native American artifacts, mm-hmm. and the intervention that was made, recognizing that those were not just simply artifacts. They were icons, and they were representative of something deeper and more meaningful. And so the intervention then, I think, became appropriate. I spent a little time down there off and on, and it was just, I mean, locally, the mood was, it was just interesting stuff. But it was interesting because of, I think, the depth that it held. But I don't think it was any sense of the depth. But I think the intervention was a way of...
Right, to change, you know, to change an artifact into a soul fact, a fact representative of soul. That rock I have out in the San Rafael Desert is near old Anastasi places. People don't know. And when I go out there, I've had some real senses of that land and the dead. And if you hike out in the desert, it's dangerous. I mean, it is dangerous. You don't just go wandering out there. But if you get out really out in deep areas of it, you can go places where other people have not been in a long, long time. And occasionally, you'll, if you dare to do it, you'll come across one of these old pictographs, an old pictograph, and it can knock you right out of your present reality to be in touch with the soul of that land and of that human who took this pigment and painted on that rock 1,000 years ago. And you can look at that painting and feel a soul artifact. It's really an amazing experience. It's a rare experience. But yeah, it happens. Let's take a little break. In this next session, the next piece of this, I've got about an hour. This was rather long. The next session's shorter. So let's just take a break for a few minutes, get a drink, go to the bathroom. I'll go into this next session, then we'll have lunch. And then we'll talk about sex and Sophia after lunch. Sex and Sophia, I promise. Okay.